William saw the man. He wore a tall silk hat that gave him extra height, and his enormous flesh seemed squeezed into his morning coat so that the buttons strained across his chest. His black beard was trimmed, his chin shaved clean in an empire style. He kept his head up. He walked casually. William knew him at once. Adam Fool's manservant. He said nothing to Shaw, but started after the giant, and Shaw quickened his pace to keep up. The chief inspector was talking about the great exhibition that had been held in Hyde Park when he was a boy, the Crystal Palace with its walls of steel and glass, the great trees it had been built around. Fool's manservant stopped at a bench and checked a large pocket watch in his vest, and after a moment, two men came along the promenade and shook hands with him, and they began to walk. One of them wore the dress regimentals of a British officer. Men doffed their hats as he passed. William interrupted Shaw, gestured. "Who's that?" Shaw followed his eyes. "Ah, Colonel Vail."
"Vail, who was in Afghanistan?"
"The very one. A hero of Kandahar. You've heard of him.
We have newspapers in Chicago, John."
"I keep forgetting you Yankees can read." Shaw smiled. "The colonel's leaving for the Congo next month. I almost pity the poor man. Look at him. A feather in the hat of your every bloody ladyship in London. You can't go out to a dinner without him being seated beside your host. I reckon he's had to let out his uniform more than the once this winter." Shaw glanced again across. "Now that other's a big bastard. Him, I don't know. But on the left is George Farquhar, the gallery owner. Sir Farquhar, someday, I'd wager. He's a friend of Lord Duggan's. His wife was rather a famous actress some years ago. There were rumours she was the mistress of the Duke of York. Has a notorious collection of diamond jewellery. Rivals Lady Margaret's, it's said. Mr. Farquhar's been drumming up publicity for a painting they say will fetch a record price at the auctions."
"The auctions?
Christie's. You never read about this? People lining up out the door to see it. It's been front page of the Times for a month." William shrugged.
"I thought you Yankees could read. I don't read the gossip."
Shaw smiled.
"Gossip is news too, my friend.
They say this painting could command £30,000. It's a painting of Emma Hamilton. Rather saucy, I understand."
£30,000 for a painting? I don't believe it.
Rumour has it your Mr. Amherst is interested. The financier." William saw Fool's manservant nod gravely and turn and make his way through the crowds, and then the two men continued in the opposite direction. He felt something, a lightness, as if he had just glimpsed some stitching in the fabric of it all, some hidden fold that held the thing together.
"You don't just get lucky," he thought. "You don't."
It was just after midnight when he awoke. He could hear the dog barking from the wire enclosure next to the pump house, and then it went quiet, and then he heard the slow drag of boots climbing the porch steps, and a pause, and then a soft knocking. Margaret was asleep beside him, and he rose from the bed and wrapped himself in his nightrobe, and walked barefoot through the house and down the wide stairs, and drew back the bolt and opened the door. It was Robert, half-dressed, his hat pulled low over his grey face.
"He's gone, William," he said. "He passed just after midnight. Never woke up."
William nodded. He stood there nodding in the darkness with his hair standing out upon his head and the sash of his robe hanging unevenly. And then he looked up and he said,
"Do you want to come in?"
And then he said, "He's gone. Jesus."
"I should go," Robert said. "Ma's back at the house.
And the kids are awake."
But he did not go.
"Come in," William said. "Come in. You want a pot of coffee?"
He turned and walked past the stairs and into the kitchen, leaving the door standing open behind him, and after a moment he heard Robert step inside and shut the door, and follow him through. He thought of Margaret upstairs.
"Margaret's asleep," he said. "Should I wake her?"
Even as he spoke it, he knew he would let her sleep. There was nothing to be done at that hour. Robert had stopped at the threshold to the kitchen and taken off his hat. William lit an oil lamp, set it on the planked table, and the scrubbed room bloomed into light. The two brothers blinked and blinked. William felt nothing. That was the shock. He had imagined this moment for days now, but had not thought it would feel so strange, so disconnected, as if it were only a rehearsal for the loss that was still to come. He banged a pot down on the stove and struck a match, and poured out a half pitcher of water, and then he sat heavily, his big hands open on the table before him. Robert said,
"It's better for him. It's better this way."
"Yes."
"He didn't want to keep suffering."
William studied his brother, the clear brown eyes swollen with exhaustion. He did not tell him how their father did not want to die. He did not say it. He said, instead,
"I guess so." "I wanted to let you know," Robert said. "I wanted to come tell you.
I appreciate it.
I guess there'll be plenty to do. Arrangements and all. Ma says she doesn't want a big funeral. I don't see how we can get around it."
William looked at his brother.
"How is she?"
Robert rubbed at his unshaven face.
"Ah, you know. She's stronger than any of us."
William nodded.
"How are you?" "It's strange."
"It is.
It's good you were with him, at the end. You were always his favorite."
Robert made a quiet noise in his throat.
"What?" "Jesus, Willie."
His brother pushed back from the table, hands white-knuckled on the edge of his chair. He stared at his boots, and after a time he said,
"I should go. I should be getting back."
But he did not go. William could hear the floorboards creaking overhead. He thought Margaret might come down, but she did not, and they sat on together in that late kitchen, their blurred reflections warping in the windows. Neither brother spoke. The water started to boil. William got up, pulled the pot from the stove. The water was crackling and belling up into vapor, and he watched it, feeling nothing at all, and then it was still, a clear, lightless, rapidly cooling thing, holding the shape of that which held it, and William stared at it a long time, wanting to plunge his hands into it, but he did not, and his brother did not speak, and slowly, around them, the huge night deepened into morning. When he called in at Scotland Yard 3 days later, it was Monday again, and the sun gone, and a fog curled over the Thames. He removed his leather gloves finger by finger, and signed in with the sergeant at the desk. It was a man he had not seen before. Then he pushed his way through the crowded halls and up the stairs, and found Shaw gruffly directing two labourers outside his office. There was a stink of fish oil in the corridor, and he wrinkled his nose at it. A massive frame of glass stood angled between the men, and they were walking it carefully through into Shaw's office, and they leaned it up against the back wall with a grunt, and it only just fit.
"Right, lads," Shaw said, though the men were old enough to be his brothers. "What's this?"
Shaw grunted.
"A gift from the Kaiser's police. Have a look."
William stepped closer. It looked to be 60 or so photographs of different women seated in the same studio. Young women, old women, some blonde, some dark, dressed in rags or finery and smiling or glowering. It might have been a rogue's gallery. William frowned and let his gaze drift from one to the next. Something was strange about it, and then he knew what it was. They each had the same eyes.
"Not just their eyes," Shaw corrected. "It's all the same woman, just done up differently."
William looked again, and then he could see it.
"Makes you think," Shaw said. "We all of us have more than the one face, but used to be I thought that was just an expression. Look at her. I think of her whenever I find myself staring at a photograph of anyone. You see what you look for. We think it's a kind of evidence, isn't it?"
Shaw shrugged and sat behind his desk and pushed a stack of papers to one side.
"I guess you didn't send for me just to show me this."
"No." William took off his hat and ran his hand through his hair.
"Well?"
"A man matching the description of your Mr. Fool was seen entering Millbank 2 weeks back," Shaw said. "Signed in as a law clerk to one Gabriel John Utterson, barrister, under the name of Mr. Guest. He was visiting our dear Mr. Rickett."
William rubbed at his eyes. "Do I look a little less crazy now?"
Shaw grunted.
Needless to say, Mr. Utterson denies knowing the man in question and claims his clerk Guest, who does exist, was with him in chambers all that day. Rose Utterson was the medium at the seance. She's the one called him Edward. William nodded. Her brother was there too. I met him. He knew Fool by sight. I expect your Mr. Fool will turn out to be a client. So we bring them all in. Catch them in the lie. Now point. Utterson will just change his story. Or someone somewhere will get paid off and the whole thing will leave you looking foolish. No. But, and here Shaw paused and stared blearily at William, I've found another connection. I know where to find your Mr. Fool next. And where is that? At a charity dinner this Saturday, a Valentine's dinner, for the Knights of the Guild, in honour of our Colonel Vale, before he sets off for the Congo. The host of the evening is none other than Mr. George Farquhar. William moistened his lips. The men from the park, he said. Aye. Now, this Adam Fool, Shaw said, I had him looked into. Seems a rather respectable gentleman. Has taken a house off Piccadilly, on Half Moon Street. Some kind of import business. An emporium for select clients. Quiet. Keeps to himself. No complaints from neighbours. No trace of him in our files. You still believe this is Shade? It's him. Shaw sucked at his cheeks, considering. I can imagine what a man like Edward Shade would want with the Colonel. William could imagine it also. There could be wealth attached to the Colonel, prestige, extended absences from England. He sat with his knuckles steepled before him, and his big feet planted on the carpet, and he stared out the dirty glass, thinking about Fool and the charity evening, and the possibilities there. How did you hear of this dinner? He said at last. We're the CID, William. We keep an ear to the ground. When you're sleeping, maybe. How? Shaw smiled. Wife's on the committee. I saw a copy of the guest list. He's to come alone. William got to his feet, started to pace. I want to be at that reception, John. I thought you might. I want to see Fool myself. If he has some sort of grift on Vale, I want to see him working it. He nodded as if considering something, and then he met Shaw's eye and he said, You should be there too. The wife will make bloody certain of it. These evenings are planned months in advance. They're damned exclusive. I don't know if I can get you in. Find a way. And tell them what? Tell them I'm principal of the Pinkerton Detective Agency. Tell them I'm a handsome example of American manhood. So you'll be in disguise. What about the entertainments after dinner? You could offer my services. William cracked his knuckles one by one, feeling his way towards an idea. Do you know? I think we can use this nicely. I think we can start a record of Adam Fool. How? You remember that dinner with the surety officials last fall? In Paris, aye. Shaw drummed his fingers on his desk. What are you thinking? An exhibition of Bertillon techniques? Why not? I can think of a reason or two. But William was not listening. We'll make it an exhibition of fingerprinting as well, he said grimly. We'll draw Adam Fool from the audience as a volunteer. For God's sake! He's a ghost, John. I've double-checked the agency's records, and there's nothing anywhere on this man. He doesn't exist, not officially. I want his measurements. I want to be able to identify him when the day comes. When the day comes? Shaw sat very still with his chin lowered and his throat in rolls around it, and then he looked up and his expression was weary and a little sad. I'll see what I can do, he said. Are you all right? I'm fine. You don't look fine. Shaw unlocked his desk and pulled out two glasses and unstoppered a bottle of whiskey from a shelf behind him, and he poured two knuckles into each glass. The dark liquid smouldering and folding in over itself, burning clear in the winter light. Talak, said Shaw. William held his glass to the light. I never found luck in a bottle yet, he said. Aye, Shaw grinned. But that there's in a glass. 31. Fool saw Pinkerton first, looming just inside the door of the Farquhar's palace,
his broad back pressed up against a marble bust, nodding with great seriousness to a knot of whiskered gentlemen. Among them the stout figure of Chief Inspector John Shaw, ugly wide face flushed. He watched Pinkerton turn to shake the hand of a man at his elbow, and saw with surprise it was Farquhar himself. Fool had not seen Pinkerton since the séance, and he felt a sudden plummeting dread in his stomach. The big detective did not see him. Fool stepped fluidly back across the lintel and let himself be jostled up against the iron railing by the other arrivals, women in their sable cloaks and fox furs, and their companions turning sideways to fit through the door. He considered abandoning his purpose, finding some other way. There were carriages and hansoms stopped along the cobbled street, their orange lanterns burning through the fog. Fool peered out with the easy, distracted frown of a man of means, and tried to think. He did not believe in coincidences. And yet there were advantages, he reminded himself, to knowing where the two men would be this night of all nights. He felt the sweep of cold air on his face, and steeled himself. After a moment he turned and pressed back in. Let Pinkerton stare. He had come to take a man's measure and leave with the means to his house, and he would not be diverted. Still, he was careful. He moved slowly along the line of arrivals and shuffled up next to Mrs. Farquhar, and greeted her with a smile and went through. He had thought to arrive late, never mind the hour. It was a Saturday evening in London in the dead of winter, and behind him the fog was already choking. He glanced cautiously around for Pinkerton, but could no longer see him, though he felt, or feared he felt, some eye upon him. He had come dressed the part, fitted in an expensive evening jacket tailored for him only 2 days previous, his high collar crisp and startling against his throat, his walking stick and top hat and white gloves. He had come to be seen. Farquhar's was an imposing mansion, cavernous, marble pillars flanking the entrance hall. Pink ribbons and white streamers tied off in bows lined the railings and sills of the hall. It was chilly, and Fool shrugged out of his coat and took off his gloves and hat, and glanced quickly across at the coat check where the gentlemen guests were crowded, and he slipped instead along the far wall and down a corridor until he reached a small cloakroom. And there he found a coat stand thick with the Farquhar's own coats. He glanced around and then shifted his hat and coat to one hand and began riffling rapidly through the pockets of the coats, but he did not find Farquhar's keys.
"Might I be of assistance, sir?"
A butler with the pallor of a corpse stood watching. Fool turned, smiled.
"Forgive me," he said. "Surely this isn't the coat check?"
"No, sir."
The butler shook his head gravely.
"Shall I escort you to your party, sir?"
Fool nodded in relief.
"Thank you," he said. "I'm afraid I'd only get lost again."
He mingled. He chatted. He laughed and charmed. He was a small man, but handsome, and he knew this, and used it to effect. Ladies admired the delicacy of his wrists. Gentlemen were drawn to his laugh. He moved through the crowd watching for Pinkerton, but each time the detective drew near, he smiled and turned away. At last he reached Farquhar and the gallerist's wife, and smiled and introduced himself again. At her throat a latticework of diamonds, gauzy and shimmering and impossibly lovely. Her hand, when he leaned down to brush his lips across it, felt cold, a diamond on each finger. Farquhar's eyes were small and creased and sat in their folds of skin like buttons, and Fool felt a shiver pass through him to see it. The man was not tall. His wife towered above them both, her throat old and sagging. She might have been twice Farquhar's age. What scandal had been strangled there, Fool wondered.
"Yes, Mr. Fool, of course," Farquhar was saying with a smile. His voice was crinkled, friendly. "It is such a pleasure, sir, to have your acquaintance."
"Likewise, sir."
"You are a collector, I understand."
Fool inclined his head. Mrs. Farquhar's long, pale fingers lingered a moment on his arm.
"And is there a particular area you are interested in, Mr. Fool?"
"Until now, American painters, early century. But I mean to fill my house here in Piccadilly with British wax."
"You have seen the Emma, sir?"
A little flash for my means, I fear. But yes, I have seen it. A fine sport all the same, Farquhar beamed. And you are located where, sir? Half Moon Street.
Why, Mr. Fool, Mrs. Farquhar said with a shy smile, we are almost neighbours.
We shall have to arrange an appointment, sir, smiled Farquhar. Perhaps this coming week. But tonight, sir, I insist you enjoy yourself and concentrate on nothing but the excellent company.
Mrs. Farquhar smiled and smiled.
George has several accomplished watercolorists in our collection here, she said. I would be pleased to show you.
I have heard as much, laughed Fool, but I couldn't possibly steal you from your admirers. They stood, the three of them, in a narrow eddy out of the crush of the crowds, and Mrs. Farquhar fanned herself politely as they spoke. Fool clapped the gallerist on the shoulder as they discussed the details, and Farquhar himself never felt a thing. Fool's hand deftly picked the man's pockets, hunting his keys. He found nothing but a handkerchief and a penknife, and an emerald ring sized for a lady's finger. As he slipped back into the crowd, he glimpsed the American detective. Pinkerton leaned against the balustrade on the second step of the stairwell, looming over the crowd, vengeful and dark. He was watching Fool with great interest. The guests in their finery drifted between them with drinks in hand. Just then a tall matron in a blue gown reached out and took his arm, and when he turned, she smiled a gruesome smile and introduced herself and her companion. They were just arrived from Boston, she said, and had been told he was a countryman. Delighted, Fool said with a bow. When he raised his eyes, the detective had disappeared. The bell rang. They went in to dinner. It was a large dining room ablaze with gas, like the great room in some modern guild hall, its vaulted ceilings painted luridly with cupids leaning over in perspective and dropping golden apples down upon the viewer, its carved mahogany beams gleaming like great black planks torn from some Spanish galleon. All was opulence and sheen. The long tables were laid out along three walls, with the Farquhars and Colonel Vale seated at the center. Pinkerton had been seated directly opposite Vale, next to Shaw and Shaw's wife, and Fool, to his surprise, was at the main table also. An enormous sculpture of a swan carved from ice was slowly dissolving on a wheeled cart between the tables. The assembled forks and knives and spoons gleamed in their ranks like instruments at a surgery, and Fool saw his own face distorted and swimming in the bowl of his soup spoon. The room was hot, and despite the thick curtains along the walls, the dozens of voices thundered up, echoing off the ceiling, and Fool found it difficult to hear. Wine stewards stood at the ready, and servers moved silent as wraiths from guest to guest, ladling out soup from great copper tureens, and Fool studied the face of each server as if seeking some resemblance. They were the invisible and the absent, and this, he knew, gave them power. He had been seated next to an old man with a powerful neck and a long scar running the length of his cheek, and his white hair combed over a bald patch at his crown. He was a clergyman.
Church of England, the man said.
A pleasure, sir, Fool replied gravely. When the clergyman gripped Fool's arm, his hand was enormous and scarred, and just visible were the faded blue lines of a tattoo.
I were a sailor near 20 years before I could rightly purchase my living, he said. It were a rough life. The seas belong to God. They don't leave a man in peace.
Indeed, Fool said. And how do you know the Farquhars? The clergyman grunted.
Thou?
Fool cleared his throat.
Ha! Just a little joke, lad. Mr. Farquhar contributes charitable works to the parish. We go back a way. You're from the colonies?
Fool grinned a puzzled grin. I'm over from New York, if that's what you mean.
Welcome to London, lad. This your first visit?
No.
Ah, now.
I keep a residence here, Fool added after a moment. I come more often since my wife passed. The clergyman shook his powerful head, his eyebrows contracting as if a drawstring around his skull had been pulled tight.
She is in a better place, sir.
Yes. Fool glanced uneasily past his companion to Pinkerton across the way. The big detective frowned at Shaw, and then stared balefully down into his soup in a savage absorption.
Fool nodded at the clergyman without listening. He could hear Mrs. Farquhar talking about the fall of Khartoum. A man next to Farquhar leaned in and said loudly,
"Do tell us about the Emma, sir."
Farquhar smiled, a cat with a canary.
"I purchased it for £12, sir. A hard bargain."
"Indeed, indeed." The clergyman laughed a sudden soft snorting laugh, and there was a gentle derision in it, and Fool realized he liked the man immensely.
"Someone should tell the poor fellow God doesn't bargain."
"Someone ought to indeed," said Fool.
"Mighty pleased with themselves, aren't they?"
The clergyman leaned over his soup bowl and took a delicate sip from the side of his spoon, and Fool wondered anew at the strange manners of the man, his roughness, his refinements.
"I wonder if it will ever change for us. I look at my brother's two sons, sir, and I think about it. There's a writer we have out in Hertfordshire who writes about that sort of thing. He thinks there will be flying carriages."
Fool turned some pale, disfigured thing over in the broth with his spoon, watched it sink again from view. He smiled.
"Flying carriages? Pulled by what? Birds?"
The clergyman smiled too.
"They'll fly on their own power, like a locomotive."
"Impossible."
"I should imagine so, though the good Lord has given us a most astonishing world already."
Mr. Farquhar leaned across and said loudly,
"And what do you think, Mr. Pickens?"
The clergyman looked up in surprise.
"About what?"
"About what?"
he asks. "About General Gordon."
"You do know they arrived only 2 days after the city fell,"
Mrs. Farquhar interrupted.
"It isn't a city, my dear."
"Of course it is. What is it, then?"
"Khartoum. Something like a walled village, I should expect. Colonel Vale, you were in the Sudan, were you not?"
The colonel was shaking his head.
"I was in Egypt, sir, but my understanding is that Khartoum is indeed a city. A walled city, that is. A village could hardly withstand a siege for so long."
Fool felt Pinkerton's eyes on him, and glanced across, but the detective was not looking at him. Mrs. Farquhar took a long, slow sip of the wine. Fool watched the diamonds at her throat flare in the gaslight. She said,
"The newspapers were all full of him a year ago. Do you remember that, darling? They said he was the only man suitable for the task. The Pall Mall made him out to be quite the dashing figure."
"Yes," Farquhar smiled. "Chinese Gordon. Sounds rather fierce, what?"
"I remember it because we had just met the general in Palestine. When was that, darling? Wasn't that just 1 year before the hell business started?"
Farquhar pursed his lips.
2 years before? Wasn't it?"
"No, 1 year. It was 1 year before. Your mother was just passed."
She turned her attention back to the table and swept it with her chin raised, her long throat exposed.
"We had no idea he was so important, you see, when we met him. He was a most peculiar man. I suppose all great men are. Is that true, do you think?"
She smiled.
"General Gordon told us he was conducting research into the geographies of the Bible. He told us one night that he believed he had located the mountain where the ark ran aground after the flood. He said he was interested in where the Garden of Eden might have been."
"How wonderful. How strange.
Isn't it, though?
What was he like?"
Mrs. Farquhar smiled and folded her chin into one cupped hand, her long thin fingers curling up the side of her face.
"Sunburnt," she said wistfully. "He walked with a kind of stumbling motion, then would glide a ways, then stumble again, as if he were always deep in thought." "I suppose he was."
"They say he has a very quiet voice. They say it's amazing he can make the savages hear him."
"Yes," she nodded. "Very quiet."
"He was a gentleman," her husband added. "Impeccable manners."
"Ah.
Did you ever meet him, sir, on your adventures?"
The colonel inclined his head.
"Regrettably, no," he said, "though I have known several of his friends and companions. I should have liked to have asked him one or two things." "What would you have asked him, sir?"
The colonel smiled. He would have asked how he managed to subdue those blasted Taipings without so much as an English musket.
"It has always surprised me,"
the colonel said softly, "how matters of the greatest importance can appear so slight from England, and how the most trivial matters can appear of consequence." The colonel cleared his throat, and his gaze fixed on Pinkerton. The table had fallen silent.
"Here, I would imagine, is a man who would understand the difference."
Pinkerton's eyes were hooded, but Fool saw him glance flickeringly in his direction.
"Colonel Vale," said Pinkerton, and nodded his head slightly, "you honour me."
"Indeed, you are both men of action," said Shaw with a mild smile. "If only the good general had the two of you with him in the Sudan."
There were murmurs of assent and concern around the table, shaking of heads, frowns.
"I understand a subscription is being raised," a lady said across from Fool, "for a charity, in his memory."
"How interesting," said Fool.
"I heard that Her Majesty wrote a letter to his sister."
"How interesting," said Fool again.
"Oh, that is such a beautiful gesture. Such a beautiful gesture."
"Well," said Farquhar with a shake of his head, "I understand Mr. Gladstone was seen at the theatre on the very evening word was received about Khartoum. Rather embarrassing for him, I should think."
"Mr. Gladstone is not easily embarrassed," the colonel said.
"It is a wonder he sleeps at all,"
Mrs. Farquhar said loudly.
"Leaving the poor man to his ruin out there. The expeditionary force should have been sent months ago."
Fool shifted his eyes and met Pinkerton's gaze. The two men studied each other, and the room seemed to Fool to recede at its edges. Pinkerton's eyes burned like twin black coals, lightless and charred. Fool lifted his glass. Pinkerton looked away. He waited until the detective was absorbed in conversation with a soft, flushed woman to his left, and then dabbed at his lips with his napkin and excused himself to the clergyman and slipped out to find the water closet. The grand hall beyond was emptied of its guests, and there were servants in satin waistcoats setting out rows of chairs. Two workmen in leather aprons were assembling a low, rough stage in one corner of the hall. He ascended the wide stairs and stood on the landing out of the lights, and watched the servants pass through the hall from the kitchens below, carrying their platters of food, and he waited until he was certain the upper floor was quiet. Then he made his way along the carpeted corridor, studying the paintings in the low light, trying the doors of the rooms as he passed. The first two were not locked, and opened on to a dressing room and a small bedchamber belonging to a woman, and Fool disregarded each. But the third door was locked fast, and he slipped a slender wire into the aperture and cracked the mechanism easily and went through. Farquhar's study. He did not open the curtains, he did not turn on any light, but stood letting his eyes adjust. He could make out leaning tubes of rolled canvases, framed paintings turned to the wall, the big desk. Fool had done his research into the gallerist, and knew Farquhar made his profits by touring through the small villages buying up paintings from the unsuspecting local poor. He could find, in a season, a lost Turner or a Gainsborough, and use these profits to float his more ambitious purchases. Not theft, but not honest. He knew also that wealth was beside the point, as Farquhar had married the daughter of a lord. There was a high bookshelf crammed with reference volumes, and a cabinet with papers in disarray. The carpet was white and thick and very soft under his feet, and he was careful to leave no impress of his footsteps where he walked. He paused when he heard someone approaching from the hall, but whoever it was walked on past. He took from his coat the sealed envelope for Farquhar, and propped it conspicuously upright against the desk lamp. From an interior pocket, he withdrew a soft lump of wax, and kneaded it with his hands to warm it until it was suitably pliable, and this he split into several smaller lumps, and folded them carefully into his handkerchief. He opened the drawers of the desk one after another, but he did not find the man's keys. In a locked drawer at the bottom of the desk, he found a loaded revolver, and he held this in his hand a moment, feeling the cold weight of the thing, and then set it back and locked the drawer. He lifted the papers on the desk and shifted the dossiers, but the keys were not there. He checked the cabinet. He ran his fingers lightly along the bookshelves. Then he saw the man's Chesterfield hanging from a hook on the back of the door. He crossed the room quickly. reached in, and pulled from the folds of the pocket a ring of heavy iron keys. 3 minutes later he was slipping sideways from the gallerist's study, and shutting the door with both hands behind him, lest it make some sound, and creeping noiselessly towards the stairs. Folded into the handkerchief in his pocket lay the soft wax impresses of each of the man's keys. The hallway was empty, the stairs bright after the gloom of the study. He could hear the muffled sound of the party far below, the low, tidal rumble of conversation.
"All this time," said a voice near him, "you were lying."
Fool froze. Pinkerton stood in the shadow of the landing, watching him. He came forward with his arms folded at his chest and his dark face melancholy and wrathful.
"Hello, Edward," he said.
Fool held his hands loose and easy at his sides, and for the first time in 20 years he nodded to that name.
"I did not think to see you here," he said.
Pinkerton smiled a bitter smile.
"I'm sure that's the truth."
"The truth is not as complicated as you imagine it."
"I imagine it to be very simple, Mr. Shade."
Fool observed the man's suppressed fury, and thought of the party below, and how alone he was with this man. Then he nodded.
"If you'll excuse me, William, I'm expected back."
He started towards the railing.
"What I don't understand," Pinkerton called to him, "is the why. Why risk it? Why come to me, of all people? A man like you must have dozens of contacts. Any of them could have traced her killer."
He stood very still.
"Did you want to be caught?"
Fool paused, turned.
"You flatter yourself.
You've caught nothing."
"No.
Your man Flood was released from prison in December. Your Mr. Utterson is the representing attorney for Martin Reckitt. You went to see Martin Reckitt at Millbank in disguise."
"What of it?"
"Your flash. Through and through." "Whatever you think you know," Fool said, "you're mistaken. A name is of no importance." "A man can change? Is that it?"
"Martin Reckitt's a friend."
"Curious friendship."
Fool smiled a cold smile.
"Aren't they all?"
Pinkerton took a step forward.
"I've informed Mr. Shaw about you. I'll let the flash world know my interest in you. The Yard will call for you on every damned investigation from here to Edinburgh. In America, my agency has already flagged you and your man Flood. I'll ruin you."
Fool shook his head.
"I live an honest life."
Something hardened in Pinkerton's face. His eyes shifted, took in the door to the study.
"You have an interesting sense of direction. Are those Mr. Farquhar's private rooms?"
Fool wet his lips. Pinkerton stepped closer.
"What would happen if I were to turn out your pockets? What would I find?"
Fool could feel the wax impressions of the keys, huge, heavy, dragging at his side.
"You came to my house," he said abruptly, changing the subject. "You harassed and threatened my serving girl. The child has been terrified. You should be ashamed."
Pinkerton met his eye, his gaze fierce.
"I know about the war," he said. "I know what you did for my father. What you did to him."
Fool stared.
"I never did anything to your father."
Pinkerton loomed within reach, and Fool was aware of the enormous bulk of the man, the thickness of his chest, the sour wine on his breath. Downstairs, a click and scrape of cutlery on china, the muffled thrum of all those voices speaking at once. He made to push past, but Pinkerton grabbed his arm and his grip was iron-like and brutal.
"You gave up my father's operative to the Confederates," he whispered angrily. "A man died because of you. A man my father trusted."
"I never betrayed anyone."
"You as good as killed him."
Fool shook himself free.
"As good as?"
he hissed, suddenly angry. There was the roar of the dinner party as the door opened downstairs and then closed, and Fool could hear the slow click of heels in the stairwell.
"Didn't you ever wonder why your father told you nothing about it?"
He looked at Pinkerton, and a long, dampened hatred began to rise. He said, very softly,
"Spa came after me. He betrayed me. I had no choice. He was shaking and he started to go, and then he turned back.
I shot the bastard twice to make sure,
he said, and then he pushed past and went back down. 32. After dinner, in the hall of chair legs scraping back and napkins collapsing, William lost sight of Fool and of the Colonel, and when he turned in his seat, his big thighs straining, he could see nothing but movement and drift. He kept turning over in his mind the thief's words from upstairs. Earlier, he had watched Fool stand and walk to the Colonel's seat and speak some emphatic message, and Vale had glanced uneasily around, then shaken the small thief's hand in reply. William could not think what Fool might be up to, but he did not like any of it. He glimpsed Mrs. Shaw gliding towards him, and he turned at once and crossed the hall and ascended the stairs without looking back, and in the shadows of the small landing he found, smoking a cigar and staring out of the darkness at the guests below, the Colonel himself, coat standing open, face drawn. He was quite alone.
"Forgive me," William said. "I didn't mean to intrude."
Vale's eyes glinted obsidian in the half-light.
"You are William Pinkerton, are you not?" the Colonel said after a moment. "You look as uncomfortable as I feel, sir."
"I wish I felt as comfortable as you look."
Vale turned and peered back down at the guests. He reached into his pocket and withdrew a second cigar. But William waved his hand no. There was a low green divan on the landing, but neither man sat.
"Look at them," he said. "I was recalled here to be at the very center of the Empire, Mr. Pinkerton. And do you know what I have found?"
"No, sir."
"I have found there is no center. They are the center."
He gestured with his cigar.
"Them."
"I've always supposed the British Empire wasn't really a place," William said.
"Then you are a wiser man than I."
William cleared his throat. He glanced quickly along the room but saw no sign of Fool.
"London is not really a place either," Vale said. "I shall be relieved to be gone from it. I think Gordon was relieved as well."
He looked at William sharply.
"I did know the man," he said. "General Gordon. It is not such a large empire that one can avoid such meetings."
"You said you never met him."
The Colonel shrugged. "It was a damned foolish spot of nonsense, sending him down to the Sudan. It was bound to end in disaster. I wonder sometimes who makes these decisions. Do they even trouble to think about it?" It was not William's empire, nor was it of interest. And Gordon, to him, remained only a man taken apart in warfare, and he had seen his share of that kind of suffering. He knew what the flesh was worth. The Colonel shifted a stiff shoulder in his dress regimentals. He said, after a moment, "The man made it perfectly clear how he would conduct the campaign even a year ago. He said he was in favor of vigorous military action."
Vigorous. That was the word. Retreat was never on his mind. Maybe he'll be proved right. A man can never tell. He said there would be no way to protect Egypt against this Mahdi if Khartoum fell. You can't fortify the south of that country. It can't be done. He said, and I remember it well, you might as well fortify against a fever. He believed if the Mahdi took back all of the Sudan, his followers would spread throughout the region. But he was like that. He was a born fighter. He never was a statesman.
Sometimes a man can surprise you, William said. Sometimes he can be two people. The Colonel grunted.
Gordon. There was never a man more completely himself. Stand him at the head of an army and he could march it anywhere. But task him with the delicate problems of statesmanship and he'd look at you in confusion.
The Colonel shook his head. He was very Old Testament in that way. Never mind the paradoxes of the Gospels. For Gordon it was always wrath and fate and might. All that slavery business last March is where he went wrong. We've had our own problems with that. Vale nodded.
Your father was an abolitionist, I understand.
William was surprised the Colonel had heard of it.
I'll miss him, said Vale,
and for a long, confusing moment William thought he was referring to his father. But then the Colonel added,
he thought the Sudan could be civilized.
He thought the slavery question could be strangled in its sleep. He was a strong, amazing, foolish man.
William felt a growing discomfort. He glanced at the room below, but could see neither Fool nor Shaw among the guests. The servants were rearranging chairs in their rows, and shifting the settees and plush sofas into position for the evening's entertainments.
"You have just come from Afghanistan, Colonel."
"Indeed, with the Emir there. And it was bloody cold, I can tell you that. I'll be glad to get down to the Congo in the spring, at least until the flies start biting."
A lady in green silk shrieked with laughter. A glass shattered.
"You'll be needed down there for your demonstration," Vale said.
"I guess so."
They stood a while then in the darkness, and a figure came halfway up the stairs and stopped with a hand on the balustrade, as if trying to determine who they were, before turning and going back down.
"I was in Alexandria 6 years ago," the colonel said. "They wanted me for the Sudan post, but I was already promised for an expedition in the Cape of Good Hope. I had to decline. I take some comfort in the fact that 15 years from now all of us will likely be in our graves, and none of this will matter at all. It will not matter that Gordon has arrived there first."
15 years, William said with a slight smile. "Too brief, too long."
The colonel smiled. They were quiet for a moment, and then Vale said,
"We have only one task on this earth, sir, and that is to live a just life."
"Who can say what that is?"
"Indeed, it's different for each of us, but always it is the surrendering of one's fate to God's will. I think of dinners such as this with a kind of horror. I understand the honor, but it makes so little sense. Why do they not throw dinners for those who need the food?"
The colonel tilted his face, the graying hairs at his temple in their tufts. He looked again out at the ladies in their taffeta mingling below, the gentlemen wheeling and drifting past. The gaslights in their sconces glittered up off the marble floor like portlights reflected in a harbor.
"All of this is meaningless.
He stretched his hand the length of his body in a strangely effeminate gesture.
"Is all just transitory and passing. Our bodies will age and die, but we shall not. They call it courage, what men like us have. It is not. It is simply a different perspective."
William said nothing. The sound of a viola tuning up could be heard drifting up from the low platform in the corner of the great room. The colonel turned then and gripped his shoulder, a sharp, strong, bruising grip.
"There," said Vale, "that's flesh. That's what I hate."
William gave him a hard, surprised look.
"You did not seem to hate it so at dinner. That man you saw tonight, at dinner, that is the man I wish to be rid of."
They were silent then, and William felt a strong affinity for the man. An affection rising. He saw in him something of his brother Robert, something of his father. The goodness sometimes found in physical strength, the directness of it.
"I wanted to ask you, sir," he said.
Vale's pale eyes studied him. "That gentleman you were speaking to earlier, at dinner, Mr. Fool, what did he say to you?" The colonel frowned.
"I beg your pardon," he said. "I don't know any Mr. Fool."
"Adam Fool. You do? I saw you together." Vale shook his head. "A small man," William prompted. "Silver hair. Very startling eyes. Almost purple."
"Ah!" Vale smiled. "Yes. He didn't give his name.
What did he want?"
"Oh, nothing from me," Vale said with a puzzled laugh. "He was asking after Mr. Farquhar."
The entertainments began. A soprano, just arrived from Finland, rose wraith-like and pale, and stood like a white flame in that vast room. She sang unaccompanied, and William, who had been lurking at the far side of the hall, seeking some glimpse of Fool, found himself instead arrested by her. He could not discern any language in what she sang, but there was Margaret combing her long hair before bed, and he went to her, and held the brush, and their eyes met in the mirror. And then he was back in London, listening. His eyes were wet. Then the girl finished, and the room stood as one and applauded. He moved grimly and quickly along the rows. He found Shaw and his wife seated near the front on a green velvet settee, and the chief inspector shifted his bulk, and the springs creaked under him, and then his wife leaned across the man's lap to tap William on the thigh with her closed fan and give him a watery smile.
"Where's Fool?"
he whispered to Shaw. But he was thinking of Farquhar and of what the colonel had said. He knew the gallerist a wealthy man, and much in the news of late with his valuable painting, the Emma. He thought of Fool's presence in the upper study, and of the huge manservant meeting with Farquhar in the park, and he understood this evening must be, for Fool, a part of some design. Nothing else made any sense. He tried to put all of it together, but he could not.
"Not yet,"
he told himself. He felt an elbow in his ribs.
"At least try to look interested,"
Shaw hissed. A man limped slowly down the rows to stand before the guests, his gait stiff as if from some old wound in the hip. He wore thick, drooping mustaches and a purple waistcoat, like a gypsy bandit from some hill country, and he stood with his long white fingers twitching and introduced himself. He had come with a rare and wondrous device he called the Zoltascope, which presented the most marvelous of images. "Paintings in light," he exclaimed. "Images of a world which is not." As he spoke, two assistants in white suits erected a tall white sheet at the front of the room and drew it taut and stepped back to one side. "It is not a trick," he said. "It is not witchcraft, though there are those who have condemned it as such. It is an example of the wonders of science. What you shall see, ladies and gentlemen, you shall not believe." William leaned over to Shaw and murmured, "Fool's been working. I followed him up to Farquhar's study during dinner. I don't know what he was up to." Shaw twisted his chin slightly and nodded behind him.
"He's watching you now."
"Where?"
"Back of the room.
Had an eye on you since you sat down."
"What did you say to him?"
The gypsy was calling for the lights to be dimmed, and his assistants were going from sconce to sconce in the great room, and the gas lights, one by one, were sinking into blackness.
"I've seen that look before," Shaw whispered. "There's murder in it."
A beam of light appeared. Smoke folded eerily through it. The white sheet burned there in the darkness like a beacon. William had seen such a device twice before, and both times it had struck him as a faintly sulfuric and unnatural display. The first time had been at a conference on charlatans in San Antonio, and the magician displaying the machinery had explained that they had once been used to conjure devils and to display the faces of the dead. The room held its breath. Through the drifting smoke appeared an eerily lit village, a river threading slowly between its winter streets. There was a bridge, a church steeple, a woman peering into a shop window, a house at the edge of the village with one light on. And then it began to snow. He heard a gasp, and Mrs. Shaw shrugged up her shoulders and glanced above as if to check for snow there. Shaw's thick hand fumbled out, grasped hers. It was a thick snow, a soft snow. It came down fast, but did not thicken on the ground. A line of geese appeared and flew slowly past the church tower. A horse and cart appeared and crossed over the bridge and left the village. All of this in absolute silence. A shepherd appeared in the foreground and drove a flock of sheep across a hill and out of sight, and then the image of the village went dark. He could hear the guests around him murmuring uneasily, and then before them glowed the image of a man, bearded, wearing a red cap and with a thick grey beard. He looked vicious, a kind of mountain bandolero. And all at once his eyes shifted, rolled back in his head, rolled forward until he was staring with fierce contempt at the room. His eyes rolled again. Nobody moved. All held their breath. William could feel the alarm and tension in the bodies around him, the tautness of the legs, the fright corded in the throats of the ladies. William shifted in his seat. The impresario was bent double beside the Zoltascope, with his wrist working, shifting the glass plates up and down. The images began to vanish and reappear more rapidly. In that beam of light, a thin sheen of sweat was visible on his lip. He withdrew the last plate and reached carefully into a box at his feet and took out another. This one had a corkscrew lever.
"Ladies and gentlemen," the man announced with a flourish, "there are those in the scientific community who call what I am about to show you a chromatrope. We do not usually expose it to the general public due to the dangers involved. I warn you, do not look directly into the center. It can have a rather disturbing effect upon the more sensitive viewers. Last year, a gentleman in Leipzig was hospitalized for several weeks after suffering an attack of nerves. Then came a beam of white light. Smoke. A geometrical pattern appeared before them. It was luminous and brilliant, and colored like a stained glass window. And slowly, very slowly, it began to rotate. It turned faster, and then the image was blurring into a stream of color and light, and William felt a brightness at the back of his skull, and he closed his eyes. Then the lights came back up. Men began to laugh. Ladies applauded softly in their gloves. Shaw pinched his eyes shut. He blinked. He shifted in his seat. "Right," he said. He set his jaw. "Let's get this done." William rose with the applause and walked to the front of the room, tugging at his shirt cuffs. Pale faces dialing towards him, ladies with their fans shushing the air. Shaw had slipped away and he came back in, wheeling a serving cart on small wheels, and the squeak of it was unsettling in the stillness. Set out upon that tray were the instruments of their trade. Pads of ink and paper, calipers, yardsticks, a photographic cabinet still closed. William cleared his throat. He did not look in Fool's direction. He raised one arm. "Many of you will know my excellent colleague, Mr. John Shaw, Chief Inspector of Scotland Yard." He smiled. He added wryly, "Don't let the title fool you. He is a very able detective." A quiet, surprised laugh from the audience. Shaw shaking his head. "Ladies and gentlemen," he clasped his hands white-knuckled in the small of his back. "For over 30 years, he began, "my agency has been engaged in investigating many of the more dramatic robberies in the continental United States. My father, the late Alan Pinkerton, my brother Robert, and myself often have had cause to personally take part in running down the thieves. One of the problems we face in modern crime detection is what to do after a crime has been committed. How are we to identify the perpetrator? Even more, how do we do it as the days and weeks go by and the trail grows colder? You will wonder, perhaps, how it is we can catch a man after so much time has passed. You will wonder, perhaps, how it is that the National Detective Agency has never yet failed to arrest a railroad hold-up man. Witness testimonies are often contradictory. How then can we be certain we have the right man?" In the stillness he could sense the intensity of the lady's eyes on him. "It is called by some the Bertillon method," he said. "It was discovered by a Frenchman of that name. You see, although as we age we change in appearance, nevertheless there are elements that do not change. Aspects of our physiognomy that stay the same despite the years. Namely, certain measurements of our faces and our hands in relation to the rest of our bodies. The distance of our eyes, for instance, from each other, as well as from our ears and our noses. The length and shape of our jawline. The length of our forearms against our palms, our fingers, our thighs. All of this, when recorded carefully and noted against a criminal's outward appearance, the color of his eyes, his hair, his skin, complexion, scars, and so on, all of this gives us the man, despite his superficial changes. Who can hide himself from himself?" The room was silent.
"Mr. Shaw?"
"Nobody," said Shaw.
"Nobody, exactly. And tonight we shall see how it is done. First, we shall need a volunteer. Are there any criminals in attendance?"
A general soft laugh rippled through the room.
"I would ask my colleague, but I'm afraid we might find a match in our files."
Shaw's big flushed grin. More laughter. William scanned the guests. Several ladies had lifted their hands, but he let his eyes rove past them.
"You, sir," he said, "you look rather suspicious."
William extended his long, thick finger at Fool, where he lingered near the curtains at the back wall. Fool shook his elegant head, held up a hand with a casual smile.
"Come now, sir," William said loudly. "There's no harm in it, I assure you."
No,
Fool was mouthing with a smile on his lips. A young woman beside him set a hand on his forearm and smiled. A gentleman shifted to make room. Others were turning to look. Shaw was already moving through the crowd towards Fool.
No, thank you,
Fool called out to Shaw. I have seen the thing done before, sir.
A round of applause for our courageous volunteer, William shouted.
Ladies applauded. Men chuckled, called out to Fool in encouragement. William could see the small thief's fury beneath the smile. But then Shaw had him gripped under one arm, and was leading him down through the guests towards the front of the ballroom, and William had stepped to the cabinet and started to clean the measuring calipers with a soft grey cloth.
"Ladies and gentlemen," William said, setting aside the cloth, "our brave volunteer."
He made a show of studying Fool's proportions.
"Ah, excellent,"
he said, and winked at the audience. "I make it a point to never ask a volunteer bigger than myself." More laughter.
"And what is your name, sir?"
"Don't do this,"
Fool said under his breath, still smiling.
"Mr. Adam Fool, ladies and gentlemen," William announced with a flourish. The room erupted in applause. "Stand here, sir, just right here. Excellent. There are many ways," he said, seizing Fool's wrists in a ferocious grip and twisting his arm to its point of weakness. "Yes, many ways to measure a man. We shall show you all of them."
General applause. Fool smiling through his teeth.
"Ah, now," said William, "you must allow us to get a clear imprint of your fingertips. The patterns on a man's fingertips are unique to him and do not change all his life. This is important, as we leave invisible prints of our fingers on everything we touch."
He could see ladies rubbing the tips of their gloves together as he spoke, gentlemen studying their own hands in interest. Fool's eyes were fixed on his, steady, level, vicious.
"We begin," he said, "by dabbing a man's fingers one at a time in ink, and then impressing them onto a formal paper."
As he spoke, he stabbed Fool's fingers onto the dark pad, then quickly rolled the man's fingertips onto the paper.
"Ah, yes. Excellent, my good sir,"
William smiled. He held up the paper for the audience to admire. "And now for the other hand," he said. Fool smiled.
"Perhaps, sir, a second volunteer could illustrate the difference between fingerprintings," he said loudly.
William gripped his left wrist and drew him unwilling back to the table.
"Perhaps,"
William smiled, and rolled the thief's fingers into the ink, onto the paper. When he had finished, the room erupted once again into applause.
"Ah, but we're not done yet," he smiled.
He led Fool to a chair and sat him down, and with a calipered instrument began to measure the distance between the man's eyes, ears, the length of his nose, the distance of his jaw from his brow. He measured the length of Fool's arms and of his torso, and he had Fool stand and roll up his sleeves, and he smiled to see a small white scar on his left forearm.
"Normally we would inspect a man and record any unique details," he said. "Scars, moles, tattoos, and so on. Given the delicacy of our volunteer, we shall refrain from such behavior this evening, but we certainly must do our best to record this gentleman's eye color, hair color, height, and so on."
During all this, Shaw's pen scratched dryly across the formal documentation for the files. William had Fool sit and stand and extend his arms until his frock coat bent out around his waist, and then sit again in the little wooden chair with his knees pressed firmly together. And at last, Shaw unbundled the camera on a tripod, using both arms, and squinted through the aperture, then moved the apparatus some 5 feet farther into the room, and then leaned again into the billowing black cloth.
William said, with a smile, "Last, but certainly not least, we always take a photograph of our criminal. And this way we can help witnesses identify possible suspects. Now, sir, I must insist you do not move, or we shall have to take the photograph again, and show these fine ladies how we restrain